Blog Talk Radio.
Of my show. I started it yesterday, had the customary glitch with audio for about 20 minutes, but then with the help of a wonderful lady at Blog Talk Radio, Sherry, we got it going and had a nice show from there. And today is the second day, and I intend on continuing it on a daily basis, Monday through Friday, until I win the lottery. And then we'll buy my own studio and we'll figure out where to go from there. Today on the show, I'm going to talk definitely about some of the politics and the social commentary that's going on in the country. We're going to start with the Iowa caucuses, who won, who lost. I kept up with it all last night. I was watching it. I did this for you. So I watched so you didn't have to in case you didn't watch it. I watched a few different networks, but primarily MSNBC. Who does a pretty even-handed job. And in fact, they really focus mostly on the Republican race, since that was the one that at first was the more exciting, but things changed later in the evening. And after I talk about those two, the Democratic and the Republican winners and who were in those caucuses, I want to discuss something that's come up online often, and it's come up the last few days. Primarily with Cam Newton and I spoke about it this morning, and I find that there's disagreements and it gets too much heat and not enough light. Culture versus race. Is there a difference? You know, yesterday I brought up the dreaded four-letter word race, which supposedly it's only supposed to be about the human race, just all of us. All 7 billion of us in this world, there's just one race. But as we know the term to be used connotatively in the United States, at least, if not around the world, race is usually about skin color, and there are differences between this person versus that person. So, and then, you know, in culture. And as it relates to Cam Newton, there is a, you know, discussion about is he polarizing or is he a positive influence? I believe he's a great player. Most people think he's a great player and don't have an issue. But, you know, he got some letters from concerned fans during the season about how he danced on the field and did certain things. And mind you, you have cheerleaders off on the side doing the dancing. And I spoke about that yesterday. But I want to talk about culture versus race. I want to talk about President Obama. And ISIS, and how have past presidents fought the war on terror? And I want to talk about how the war on terror versus the Islamic, the terror that is basically based in the Middle East, how did that start? You know, President Obama came in and did not start this war on terror, but he certainly has had a big part in trying to defeated, and people want him defeated. He is being accused of not doing the things that are necessary to end the war on terror. So I want to talk about how that started. I want to talk about a group of people. We talk so often about the Middle East and the war on terror and terrorist attacks that have happened in Europe, in Paris, France. We had one in San Bernardino last year. How about the one in Africa with the group Boko Haram? There was just 86 children killed 2 days ago, and it went without basically any, hardly a mention in the American press that I've seen. Then I'm going to talk about what this, and this term has always kind of bugged me. What's the, who is the greatest generation? What's, who is the greatest generation? Problem with that phrase, and I'll tell you why I've had a problem with it. We'll talk about Sarah Palin. Have to have some words about Sarah Palin and how she, in fact, I believe, affected this this political race that where she went and spoke for Donald Trump. And did that have an effect on him, whether he actually will win the nomination? So we're going to talk about Sarah Palin and try to decipher a few of the things she has said in the past. It's hard to, but we'll give it a shot. I want to talk about Bernie Sanders. Obviously, we're going to talk about the Iowa caucuses, but I want to talk about how the problem with Bernie, my problem with Bernie. I don't have a problem with him, but the problem with Bernie and how it would be a problem for him if he were to become president or in trying to become president, why there is an issue. I'll talk a little bit about the Super Bowl. There's still some things going on. Today is media day, so the players are out there and talking, and Peyton Manning, this may be his last game, so I'm gonna bring up talk about that a little bit, and we'll discuss that. And also, if I get to it today, because it's actually something I wanted to talk about tomorrow, and it kind of folds into the whole culture, race issue, is why does Reverend Al Sharpton cause so much anger amongst people? You bring up the name, and it's polarizing. It's one of those polarizing things, and I think that's one of the things that I will try to use this show for, is to talk about sometimes polarizing issues and see if I can find not necessarily the middle ground, but I may fall on one side or the other, but try to decipher what's going on. Try to bring some light instead of heat, because oftentimes there's too much heat brought to a discussion and don't get to exactly what the issue is. So in example with Reverend Sharpton, people are, don't like him. They're angry. They think he's all out for money. Well, we are in a capitalistic society. What is it that really bothers you about him? And when you get to that specific question, then that's where it gets a little muddled, and you can't really, people sometimes can't decide exactly what it is that bothers them. So those are the things, topics I'm trying to cover in the next, well, it was 90 minutes. Now it's about 80 minutes, hour and 20 minutes, and I'll try to discuss them. If anyone wants to call in today, the guest call-in number is area code 323-375-3238. I'm going to start with the Iowa caucuses. I see, I think I have somebody online. Could that be somebody online? Do I have somebody here? Hello? Is there someone there? There's someone that called in, but they are not speaking. So I will hang up. We'll hang up that one. Let me start with the Iowa caucuses. And we will start with, let's see, do I want to start with the Republicans or the Democrats? Well, let's go in reverse order. Let's start with the Republicans. So, the last 3 or 4 months, Donald Trump has been the biggest thing in politics and in social commentary in this country with his campaign to run for president. His belief that because he is a businessman, that he knows the right things to do, primarily build a wall on the southern border of the United States that Mexico will pay for to keep those bad, bad Mexicans out of our country who are taking our jobs and raping our women. And he has seemed to have won a percentage of the people in the Republican Party, at least, who believe in him. And there was a sense that he was building up to winning the Iowa caucuses that were held yesterday. So there was an upset, a slight upset, even though he was the person that was going to win the Iowa caucuses when they actually went out. And Iowa caucuses are kind of different than how we normally vote. We normally go and vote and get in a little booth and do it privately amongst, you know, each other, you know, you don't talk to the person next to you. They don't know what you voted. And that's how we normally vote in most of the United States, in most states. A caucus is more, you're getting into a big room. You're amongst a group of people, and you may stand in a group of people. You're all for Trump, and right next to you is a group of people, and they're for Ted Cruz, and over here is another group of people for Marco Rubio, and you're discussing amongst each other why you feel this way or that way. You're basically in public trying to persuade others to come to your... It's a very democratic, small D way of voting. I like the privacy, the private way of doing it, the way we are known to have done it. But a caucus is another way of doing it. People like it. It's, like I said, very democratic. And last night, Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, beat Donald Trump. Donald Trump came in second place. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, came in third place, a surprising third place. And then the rest of them were thrown into a big pile in the back. Jeb Bush was down. Carly Fiorina, who didn't even show up at her campaign party after the caucuses last night. Governor Christie, Governor Kasich, they all did nothing. And there may be a few Republicans that are going to come out of the race that will no longer be running after next week when they have the New Hampshire primary. So my uptake on what happened last night in the Republican Party is I think the person that did the best, obviously Ted Cruz won the race, but Marco Rubio was a surprising third place. And I think he did a very deft job over the last 3 or 4 months of not making himself, you know, Donald Trump has had this thing of whoever has attacked him, he goes right back at them directly and he name calls them and puts them down. And then these Republicans have, politicians have pretty much shut up. You know, if Donald attacks me, I'm going to stop and not let him continue attacking me. I don't want to be name called because he had such a following. Marco Rubio tended to lay low. He didn't really get involved on a one-on-one with Donald, didn't attack him, but slowly built up his campaign in Iowa, built up the amount of people who were favorable to him, and he came through with a surprising show of third place. He's only about 1%, one percentage point behind Donald Trump for second place. So he did a very good job. Marco Rubio is seen as the young up-and-comer, the Republican version of then-Senator Obama from 2008. I think he's a little lightweight. I don't feel like he has any substantive proposals. And if he is the nominee in that party, while he will be a attractive candidate, I don't believe he can beat Hillary Clinton, who is the possible nominee in the Democratic Party. In terms of Donald Trump, someone who was thought to have was going to win that Iowa caucus up until yesterday, I think Sarah Palin hurt him. I think having Sarah Palin as a friend, as someone who supported Donald Trump, was not a good thing. The lady can hardly put together two sentences. And I don't think her whole PTSD, and in fact, the day, literally the day that she came out to support Donald Trump was the day her son also was up in Alaska in this fight with his girlfriend, where he had a physical altercation with his girlfriend, domestic violence, holding a gun. So all that came together, and she was complaining about PTSD, and our soldiers have PTSD, and, you know, President Obama is not the right president to have when our soldiers come back from war having this PTSD. She mixed a whole lot of things together, and it made it sound like she was accusing the president, President Obama, of causing our soldiers to have post-traumatic stress syndrome, PTSD. Now, when she was called on this, she obviously, oh, what do you mean? I don't know what you're talking about. That's not me. I wouldn't do anything like that. it's kind of hard to really know what Sarah Palin says when she says it, because if you can follow her, you're a better person than I. Because, I mean, some of the stuff that she actually says is really, really hard to follow. It doesn't make sense. I'll give you, for instance, this is what she said the day, and I'm going to read this, and let's see if you can figure it out. This is Sarah Palin. I can talk personally about this. I guess it's kind of the elephant in the room because my own family, going through what we're going through today with my son, a combat vet having served in a striker brigade fighting for you all, America, in the war zone. But my son, like so many others, they come back a bit different. They come back hardened. The question, though, that comes from our own president, where they have to look at him and wonder, do you know what we go through? Do you know what we're trying to do to secure America and to secure the freedoms that have been bequeathed us? So when my own son is going through what he goes through coming back, I can certainly relate with other families who kind of feel these ramifications of PTSD and some of the woundedness that our soldiers do return with. And it makes me realize more than ever, it is now or never, for the sake of America's finest, that we have that commander-in-chief who will respect them and honor them. Huh? What was that? So Sarah Palin, yesterday on the Today Show, got upset. And this is what she said.
Trail, which is the arrest of yours. President Obama may be to blame for some of the PTSD that's out there. Well, let's take it piece by piece. What exactly did you mean?
Let's start piece by piece by you guys brought me here to talk about Iowa politics and the caucus tonight, not to talk about my kids. And that was a promise. But as things go in the world of media, you guys don't always keep your promises, evidently.
Do you regret the comment, though, Governor Palin, on that day of the endorsement?
What did I say that is offensive?
That you seem to lay it at the feet of the president.
I don't regret any comment that I made because I didn't lay PTSD at the foot of the president. But, no, if you guys have a specific quote, it allows the media to be more credible if you guys will tell me exactly what you're talking about, and then I can address
it. There were no specific promises made about content of the interview, only that this would be your first interview since you endorsed Donald Trump.
Let me ask you something. I just gave you the quote that Sarah Palin gave 2 weeks ago when she endorsed Donald Trump. Can you figure out what she was talking about other than mentioning PTSD and our commander-in-chief and PTSD and some of the woundedness that our soldiers do return with? And it makes me realize more than ever, it is now or never, for the sake of America's finest, that we have that commander-in-chief who will respect them and honor them. What was she talking about? So this is the problem that Donald Trump had in having Sarah Palin endorse him. She's not credible. She is a joke. She is a walking conundrum of nothingness. And I believe that is why Donald Trump lost Iowa. And he's now going to have some real problems going forward. He's going to continue being Mr. Trump bluster and yelling and screaming. But I think he's been knocked off his throne a little bit. It'll be interesting to see what happens next week. Now, he was the leader in New Hampshire. So it is his state to lose next week. And it is not a caucus. It is normal. You go to the voting booth and you vote. One thing about New Hampshire, though, it is a Republican primary, but anyone can vote in that election. New Hampshire has an open primary system where even if you're a Democrat, you can vote in the Republican primary. So there could be some hijinks up there in terms of having some Democrats that would vote in the Republican primary next week. But Donald Trump's got some issues. Now, Ted Cruz was running second or third in New Hampshire. And Marco Rubio, with his strong showing last night, could very well be the person that comes on and wins. And if that's the case, if Marco Rubio comes on and takes New Hampshire next week, Donald Trump not only has some problems, he'll continue to run, because next is South Carolina. But Ted Cruz now will have that conventional politician to run against, because Ted Cruz running against Donald Trump, that's the Donald Trump needs to understand politician. Being a politician is a profession too. We may criticize them a lot, but it is something that is a profession. And if Donald Trump thinks that he can just walk in here and win races just by saying, I'm going to build a wall and Mexicans this and Mexicans that, and I'm going to make sure we have no refugees come to this country, he's got another thing coming. It's now going to get a little tougher for him. And now you're going to have two conventional politicians, although Ted Cruz is on the outside. He does not have a lot of support amongst Republican elected officials in Washington, D.C. It's going to get tougher for Donald Trump. It's going to get tough for Ted Cruz in New Hampshire. I don't see him as the winner in New Hampshire. I believe Marco Rubio may be able to overtake Donald Trump next week in New Hampshire. Stay tuned. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders from Vermont, certainly has invigorated the electorate. He's got great crowds. People come out to see him. They're cheering for him. He is saying the things people want to hear. You know, we had that issue about 5 years ago. We had the demonstration in New York City. It's called Occupy Wall Street, and it was all about the 1% versus the 99%. And this has been Bernie Sanders, like I said yesterday. If you go back and look at a video of Bernie Sanders from 1972, 1974, Bernie Sanders is talking about the same thing that he's talking about now. So he has been consistent in what his focus is. It's on the top 1% taking all the money and not doing anything with it, not investing, the whole trickle-down Ronald Reagan of the 80s, give tax cuts to the wealthiest and they will trickle down. The money will come down to the middle class, the working class people. It didn't happen that way. And the rich have just gotten richer. So that has been Bernie Sanders' focus for the last 40 years. He has built a campaign on it. And in this particular presidential cycle, and he is a threat to Hillary Clinton. I believe he made Hillary Clinton a better candidate in Iowa. She was challenged these last 3 to 4 weeks as the race got tighter, and she had to work her butt off to win Iowa, and she barely won it. I mean, she won it by less than 1%. I think it's down to 0.3, 0.4%, and they did not have a actual declared winner until overnight, sometime early this morning. So it's made Secretary Clinton a better candidate. I believe that she will continue and go on to New Hampshire, where Bernie Sanders last week was prescribed to win by 30%. He is definitely up in New Hampshire, being that it's a state next to his home state of Vermont. He is scheduled to win the New Hampshire primary, but I believe Hillary Clinton is going to do a very good job. She's going to work hard and try to win that race. And I think all along the idea has been, if you are a supporter of Hillary Clinton's, which I can say that I am, it is good that she has competition and strong competition. Bernie Sanders is going to win some primaries. I do not believe that he will win the nomination. I still believe Secretary Clinton is the best candidate for November to run against whatever Republican comes out. But it is a good thing for her to run on against and adapt some of Senator Sanders' principles in terms of economics. My issue with Senator Sanders is that he is fairly Johnny One Note. If you ask him about foreign policy, you don't get a really in-depth answer. It's basically a variation of financial top 1% and 99%. You don't get any sense that he has spent any time, and there have been news stories the last few days that have basically said that the foreign policy advisors that were supposed to talk to him have either not spoken to him or spoken to him one time. He hasn't put a lot of focus on that. His focus is on the economy. And while I appreciate that, presidents have to do more than one thing. There's just no doubt. They have to do more than one thing. And there's more than one way to solve issues. Senator Sanders has one way to solve the issues, to tear down the banks. I don't know what people are going to do who have bank accounts. Forget the top 1%. How about the middle 40%? He really hasn't explained his whole economic proposal. He has gone into some detail about his health care plan, where he wants to get rid of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, ACA. But even that would cause some consternation and upheaval. And the bottom line is, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat at this point in time. He is a socialist. Like I spoke yesterday, we have a lot of socialism in this country. A lot of it. We use it all the time. Social Security, form of socialism. Insurance payments, form of socialism. We use sports owners. When they get the millions and billions of dollars from the TV stations for use for their the TV rights, they split it amongst themselves equally, not based on who has made the most money. Equally, everyone gets the same cut. So socialism is definitely used in our capitalistic society. There's no doubt. So I'm not shrinking from the term socialism, nor do I use it as a pejorative against Senator Sanders. But when he talks about things that he wants to do, policies that he wants to implement, everything can be executive order. He can't just sign a piece of paper and make it so. And more importantly, and to the point, who in Congress, between the House of Representatives and the United States Senate, is going to be with him? Who is going to carry his proposals through the Congress to sign these bills? And we haven't figured that out yet. So until we can get an understanding of that, I believe Secretary Clinton has a much better track record of working with Republicans and Democrats. My goodness, it should carry through a bill and have it signed by President George Bush, where she worked with House of Representatives, the majority leader, Tom DeLay. She can work with him. She can work with just about anyone. So, and again, yesterday I did talk about the fact that she did support the war in Iraq. It was a calculation that she made, and obviously, yes, then Senator Obama used that against her in 2008. I don't think that can now be used against her again. I just don't think you can keep running on the fact that she voted for the war in Iraq. She trusted a president who, with Dick Cheney and the minions in that Bush administration, went way beyond what they were supposed to do. And yes, she made a calculation that she wanted to be seen as tough on foreign policy and not a dove. So I get why she did it. President George W. Bush handled that whole war, even going to war in Iraq. He handled it horribly. It was just a mistake. So I don't think Senator Sanders can use that this time against it. It was used in 2008 by then Senator Obama against Hillary Clinton. I think that's run its course, and Senator Sanders is going to have to find another way. In terms of Senator Sanders using President Obama as an endorser, last week he met with him. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the two of them deal with politics in a totally different way. I literally believe that President Obama plays chess and everyone else, including Senator Sanders, plays checkers. And what this president has done in his second term, with a divisive political climate, having a Senate that is against him. Look at what has he done? Look at what he's done. Let's even start with the first term. Obviously, the Affordable Care Act. He managed to lower unemployment. He saved the auto industry. He captured and killed bin Laden. He helped plant the seed to start help raising the minimum wage. Certainly not nationally, but you've seen it over in different cities all over the country. The minimum wage is being raised. He lost the Senate in 2014. Since he lost the Senate just 2 years ago, less than 2 years ago, he's helped to reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba. He placed an executive order to shield 5 million undocumented immigrants from deportation, rejected the Keystone Pipeline, helped to establish worldwide action on climate change, supported marriage equality that the Supreme Court then confirmed, and negotiated a nuclear deal with Iran. Compare that to how Senator Sanders wants to, or Senator Sanders' proposals to rein in the financial industry, and I just don't see it happening. I just don't see Senator Sanders having that same knack for negotiation and patience. Because what Senator Sanders wants is he wants what he wants now. And I just don't see that happening. This next week, the New Hampshire primary will be interesting. Senator Sanders should win that one. But I think it will be a close race. It should be less than 10%, even though the polls a week ago showed him up by 30%. I think it will be closer than that. So that's the Iowa caucuses. This whole year will be nothing else about the political races and the politicians in them. Let me talk about this whole issue of culture versus race, because it's been out there. It's always talked about. People, I had someone this morning who got a little peeved at me, I think, and this was an issue regarding Cam Newton, quarterback for the Carolina Panthers, that doesn't understand why, and this happens to be a woman who happened to be white, doesn't understand why he, I think I like him. I don't follow sports a lot, but I think he's a good player. But I'm not sure why we always have to talk about, why does race have to always be talked about? Well, why does race have to always be talked about? That gets into such a huge issue. Again, like I've tried to say before, race is shorthand for color as opposed to the human race. I wish we had a different way of describing it, but race has to be the shorthand way of talking about it. So why does race have to be talked about? It has to be talked about, and it is talked about amongst Black people in general, because it has been a part of their our lives. In relation to Cam Newton, let's be specific about Cam Newton. As a quarterback, let's back up with football. What are some of the terms that we use in football? We talk about blitzes. We talk about making a defensive stand. We're talking about the bomb, throwing the bomb. We use a lot of military terms in football. It is seen as a warrior culture. And in that warrior culture that is so ingrained in our American society, that is so closely associated with war and the military, as you see us play the Star Spangled Banner before games and planes fly overhead, the quarterback is seen as the, what is another name that he's called? A field general. And there has been a certain way over the last 40, 50 years in the NFL primarily that a field general is supposed to act. They are supposed to have poise. They're supposed to be calm. They can have a little passion. Passion is okay. Nothing wrong with passion, but not too much showmanship. Don't get out there and dance around, act like you haven't done this before. And what has happened, and I say it's as much culture as it is race, that there had, and for a long time, especially in the National Football League, Black quarterbacks were not allowed to be quarterbacks. They would make them wide receivers, or they'd have to play on defense, or they'd become a running back, because they were not seen as having the necessities, as that famous word from Al Campanis in baseball, talking about why blacks weren't necessarily baseball managers, because they didn't have the necessities to be a manager. So they didn't have the critical thinking designed to run a team, which we've found that to not be the case. But that was the same thing that was in football. Quarterback, football players, you could play all the other positions, but quarterback was seen as one where you had to be analytical. And with Cam Newton specifically, there was a quote by a scout as he was coming out of Auburn University, where he had just won a national championship, and he was going to be the number one draft pick in the NFL, that critiqued him and said that he ran a, quote, ninth grade offense at Auburn. Now, what does that mean, ninth grade offense, if he is a 20, 21-year-old in college? That sounds like someone who can't really run a very sophisticated offense, that the verbiage that you use as a quarterback in the National Football League and the actions that you have to, the footwork that you need, the passing accuracy that you need, may not be what he could do. He may not be capable of it. Ninth grade offense. So that's what Cam Newton walked into. Well, he has obviously taken the time. He has honed his craft. He has certainly gotten better. I thought that there were things he needed to work on coming out of college, but he has gotten better. And now he is at the top of the league. He will probably be named the National Football League's MVP after the season's over. So these are the type of things that in society people think about. Black people understand that they have not always been viewed as the people that can play this particular position. And also, if I may add, that Cam Newton's one of his favorite sponsors, one of the people that has helped him, a mentor, if you will, has been Warren Moon. Now, if you're not familiar with who Warren Moon is, he went to the University of Washington. Warren Moon is a contemporary of mine. I remember when at the University of Washington, he helped his team as quarterback win the Rose Bowl. He was a very good quarterback in 1978, 1979. And as he came out of college, he was not drafted by the NFL. They did not see him as a quarterback, not as a starting quarterback. So he went to the Canadian Football League for 6 years. He won their equivalent of the Super Bowl, the Grey Cup, with the Edmonton Oilers, that's the hockey team. I'm not the Edmonton Eskimos, possibly. He won the Grey Cup a few times up there. And after 6 seasons in the Canadian Football League, he then was deemed capable to come down and play in the National Football League. So after 6 years in the Canadian Football League, what did Warren Moon do by the end of his career in the National Football League? He is still in the top 10 in touchdown passes and yardage thrown. Warren Moon. He proved his worth. So there has been this thing over time, over the last 30 years, where black quarterbacks have had to prove their worth. That is what Cam Newton understands. And while he has not had the same hurdles that Warren Moon has had to go through, I think it is fair for him to understand where he has come from. And I think sometimes people dismiss that why does he talk about this? Why does he have to say he's African-American? Well, there is a history, and there is a history since he's been born, literally. I mean, Cam Newton was born in 1990. Warren Moon was still playing. This is something that he knows. And the fact of the matter is, culturally, Cam, being the young kid he is of hip-hop, of the hip-hop era, likes to do a little showmanship. He likes to dance a little. So when he gets in the end zone, he's going to do the Superman pose and the dab. When he makes the first down, he makes the gesticulations with his hand. It's a first down. He's done that since college. since college, now he's brought in the whole Superman pose, and it turns people off who are used to Bart Starr and Don Meredith and Terry Bradshaw and Dan Marino, who would definitely get in somebody's face every now and then, Dan Marino, and Joe Montana and Phil Simms and Boomer Esiason. It's a different style, and it rubs some people the wrong way, so much so that during this past season, a lady, and it's been talked about often, wrote a letter to Cam saying that she did not like the fact that he did a lot of dancing and such on the field, and why does he see the need to do that? People have in their minds a certain way of doing things, and Cam is upsetting that natural order. That is why race is discussed. It doesn't mean that people are racist. And I think that is what too often happens, is that people get uncomfortable talking about race and culture. And I, depending on what it is I'm talking about, I'll use the terms interchangeably. Culturally, Cam likes to dance, just like it's a culture of some people in churches. Some churches like people to get up out of their seats and they have the Holy Ghost. That can be a white church or a black church. It's a Pentecostal church or a Baptist church. Some churches, people sit quietly with their hands folded and listen to the pastor and bow their heads in prayer and don't hardly say a word other than singing the hymns. Other churches, people are up dancing in the aisles, dancing in the pews. That's a bit of a culture. Culture is also how you express yourself in the foods you eat. That's cultural. Culture is different things, irregardless of skin color. But race, as we commonly use the term, makes a difference. And it has always made a difference in this country, the United States. Yes, the greatest country on the earth, where freedom is revered. It has made a difference here because sometimes people haven't always been able to aspire to the jobs that they can do well. And Cam is doing a job that he can do well that wasn't always available to him. Muhammad Ali was not a very popular person because he said things and did things. How dare he not go to Vietnam? Who does he think he is? People who upset the natural order are going to get criticized. And like I said, Cam is pretty popular. Every time he scores, he hands the ball to some child in the stands. That to me seems like a fairly nice thing to do. People are now even criticizing that. What about the people 50 rows up? They can't get a ball. Why does he only give the ball to the people that are right there in the front row in the end zone? Sometimes you can't win, I think, is what the real issue is. And I think, again, this whole thing of culture and race, it's okay to talk about. It's okay to talk about. Talking about race does not mean either party is racist. It's just a way of race, culture, a way of doing things based on who you are. And I think if we can get to that point more often, I think there's sometimes we do have discussions where that's able to discuss and it's discussed in an adult manner, but too often it gets into heat and not light. Which brings me to Reverend Al Sharpton and why he causes so much anger. Now, one of the things and this is over the years, this is since the 1980s, so we're talking about a lot of time. What I've noticed over the years is that oftentimes people who do not like the Reverend Sharpton, and it used to be Reverend Jackson was also included in this mix, but he is now kind of taking a step back. He's not so much in the mix anymore of day-to-day advocacy of certain issues. So Reverend Sharpton is there. He has a television show on MSNBC, so he's still in the public eye a little bit more than Reverend Jackson is. But they used to be twins. People used to just hate both of them together because they would stick their nose into, as they would perceive, stick their nose into things, and all they're looking for is money and publicity. why does Reverend Sharpton cause so much anger? People don't like the fact that he sticks his, basically what I can gather is people, first of all, don't like that he sticks his nose into issues. I had this discussion last week with a very good friend who happened to be white. He sticks his nose into too much. Well, okay, sticks his nose into too much. Can you be more specific? Like, what is it exactly that bothers you? Well, why does he have to get involved? Again, in order to ask that question, which is a question, it's a valid question, you then have to understand what is going on when he has gotten involved in certain issues over the years. Oftentimes, he has gotten involved in issues regarding police brutality. Before we had cell phones, when people did not want to believe him, and all you would see is the person who was now dead, or as in the infamous case of Abner Louima, a Haitian who lived in New York, had a toilet plunger, the stick shoved up his rectum, or Sean Bell, a guy who was getting ready to get married out with his entourage, his best man and his all the people that were going to be part of his wedding, shot and killed coming out of the side of a party or a nightclub, it was. These are the type of people who, when these families have these tragedies happen in their life, they need someone to speak for them. It's not enough to just say, there was a killing, and we now have to bury our loved ones, and that's it. No. No. No one would want that to happen if they think that there's something else untoward happened, if they think that there was some police misconduct. And that is what Reverend Sharpton was doing through the 1980s and 1990s, representing people in the public eye, going in front of the cameras, speaking for people who didn't have a voice. Now, did he make mistakes along the way? Yes, he did. He was human. And Tawana Brawley is the biggest one that comes to mind. He vouched for a young teenager who said that she was abducted, taken into the woods, had feces smeared all over, and put into a bag, I believe, and left out in the woods to die. It turned out to be a hoax. But he believed a 16-year-old. And he may not have exactly apologized at the end of it in the most perfect way. I don't have all the details in front of me. But my bigger picture is when people have had issues regarding police deaths or police shootings, and he has represented the families of the deceased, I'm glad he's there. So people say, well, why does he get paid? He's just out there to make money. Well, excuse me, last time I checked, I thought we lived in a capitalistic society. Yes, he has a right to represent people who have grief and have some anger toward the police department or institutions, but should he? Is it wrong? Is it illegal to get paid? Is it illegal for him to have airfare or hotel fees paid for? I don't get that. So again, I tend to ask, what is it that he does that makes you angry? Should he not represent these people? Should people not want him? And he was often, more often than not, asked for. It wasn't that, oh, somebody got shot by the police, let me go run up and get in front of the camera. No, 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 no. That's not how it happens. That's not how it works. That's not how it works. People request him, just like the late Johnny Cochran in Los Angeles. People requested him. He didn't go. He wasn't ambulance chasing. People knew how to contact Johnny Cochran in the community. And if there was issues involved that he could be a help to as a lawyer, as the preeminent lawyer of his day, you better believe Los Angeles citizens would call him. And if he could take the case, he took it. And in taking the case, that means he would sometimes be in front of the news cameras because people knew that he won cases against the LAPD and Daryl Gates, who was the police commissioner at the time. But I think one of the things we found out in the last 5 years about this whole issue with Reverend Sharpton and representing people who've had issues with the police is that now we have cell phones. with cameras and video. And we've seen some things that we didn't used to see before, including not only including people being shot, but people being shot and then literally watching the officer plant the weapon on the deceased person. That happened in North Charleston, South Carolina. So the things that we complain about, these things are actually happening. Why is he out there so much? Why is he always complaining about the police? He's an anti-police. He's this and this. He just causes trouble. He makes it tougher. Sometimes individual police officers make it tough on themselves. And with the number of issues that we have seen over the last just 2-3 years, much less last 20, 30 years, but now that we can see with video, we can see that there has been some issues. And there was a reason why we needed people out there speaking for the families of the deceased. So I'm glad that there's someone like Reverend Sharpton who can stand in front the slings and arrows. And by the way, there are a lot of black people who are not fans of him. They think he's a charlatan and think he's so this is not just black versus white. But he ran for president twice. And I believe the last time he ran for president was in 2004. And in the primaries, he didn't win any, but he got 30% white vote. 30% of his vote was white. So it's not like he is someone who is against white people. He is against wrong. And we all get to, at one time or another in our life, get to perceive what is wrong and what is right. He has done it, put it upon himself to take the stand and say, I'm representing this family because something happened that doesn't add up. And people can criticize me for it. That's fine. But we need to find out what the truth is. And like I said, we found out now in the last 2 or 3 years with the nature of everyone having cell phones and pictures and videos, found out there's a lot more going on and dash cams. He wasn't always wrong. So I have no issue with people criticizing him, but just understand what it is that you're criticizing for. And we live in a capitalistic society where someone is allowed to make money. It's okay. It really is okay. My next issue, and if you have any questions or anybody wants to call in on that, again, my guest call-in number is 323-375-3238. It comes up every now and then. It's definitely culture and race, Reverend Sharpton. It comes up a lot. And sometimes it comes up and I have to ignore it when different people talk about it because I know that they are not there to hear reason. It's more invective and nastiness, and I'm not interested in that. It's just ridiculous. Let's change the subject. I want to talk about the president again, President Obama, and this war on terror that he is fighting and that he has been heavily critiqued and criticized on, fighting the war on terror. I'm someone that's always been interested in how different presidents have dealt with foreign policy. I'm not just someone that's interested in, one aspect of a presidency. The president has to do more than one thing. So foreign policy is a huge issue when you're the commander in chief. I believe in the United States having a muscular foreign policy. Sometimes there are things that need to be done in the world. The world is not always a nice place. We cannot be doves every single time. There are times where the United States has to use their power. Should we have military in most countries of the world? You know, that can always be looked at and seen where we can do a cost benefit analysis to see whether that is needed or not. But in terms of post 9/11, should the United States retrench and just make sure that no one comes into the America? I don't think that's possible. I think we have to be out in the world, because that is the only way that we will be able to effectively fight a war on terror. I don't believe that we can fight a war on terror post 9/11 by bringing all of our military back in from Asia, bringing all of our military back in from Germany and in Western Europe, bringing all of our military back in from the Middle East and South of Saharan Africa. We cannot pull back and bring in all of our ships and just place them around the borders of the United States and believe that we will be safe. I don't think that's going to work. So there has to be a war fought on terror, but it has to be fought smartly. And this president has been criticized for his fight on the war on terror because he has not been tough enough. They say he hasn't been tough enough. I can rightly say that President Obama, if you know anything about what's going on the last 8 years, 7, 8 years in his presidency as it relates to the war on terror, obviously the signature moment was the capturing of Osama bin Laden. The previous president, Bush, certainly wanted to capture him, but he didn't. He did not capture him. This president did. Beyond that, the thing that I can critique, and by the way, at the beginning of this, of his term back in 2009, he made a very important speech in Egypt where he opened himself up to the greater Arab Muslim world and wanted to find a way to build bridges. Now, when you have a country like Iran, who I believe as a country is a great country, but the mullahs, the religious leaders who run that country, are out of hand. They're ridiculous, and they are bent on terror and mayhem and death. And Iran could be a potentially great partner, but somehow they have to overturn their religious leadership because it is not serving that country well. And that is why that up until this nuclear deal with Iran, they were not seen as a credible partner. Obviously, way back when, 30 years ago, they did the hostage taking. And then in the 1980s, there was a huge war, Iran-Iraq war. That was the first Gulf War. That was literally called the Gulf War until the United States had the war with Iraq. And when that Iran-Iraq war was fought in the 1980s, President Reagan helped Iraq because he wanted to defeat Iran. And how did he help Iraq? Through the Commerce Department. He kind of did a little around. He didn't do it directly. He went kind of around the way so people wouldn't catch it. Through his Commerce Department, not through the Defense Department, through the Commerce Department, he sold Saddam Hussein the materials, not the exact bombs, but Iraq had to put them together. But he sold them the materials to make chemical weapons. Because President Reagan's administration thought, let's really stick it to Iran. We're going to give Iraq the parts to make chemical weapons, and I want you to use it on them. Well, what ended up happening? There was a limited chemical war against Iran by Iraq, but Iraq eventually also used those chemical weapons on their own citizens, the Kurdish, in the northern portion of Iraq. And that is what's often been criticized about Saddam Hussein. He used chemical weapons against his own people. Well, where did he get those chemical weapons from? People don't take the time to ask the question, where did he get those chemical weapons from? So the 1980s are important because in so many different ways, the beginning of anti-U.S. attacks by Islamist groups started in the 1980s. I'm not talking about airplane hijackings of the 70s when people would come on board airplanes and hijack them and take them to different countries. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about literally taking a truck filled with explosives, driving it through barriers, crashing it into a building, the driver being a suicide person. He dies with the explosion, and blowing up embassies, blowing up military barracks. When did that start? Most people say it started in 1983, during the Reagan administration. The war on terror started in the 1980s, and it started with the embassy bombing in April of 1983. There were 63 people lost in the embassy bombing. Literally, a person drove a truck into the building, crashed it into the building, and the bombs inside exploded. 63 people died, including 17 Americans, 8 of whom were CIA personnel. This was in Beirut, Lebanon. 4 military people. The rest were clerical. 17 Americans, 63 total. That was April 1983. In October 1983, and this is the one people normally remember, is the barracks bombings, the U.S. military barracks bombings. Again, in Beirut, Lebanon. 241 Americans, military killed, 241, including 220 Marines, over 300 people all told killed, including some French. What was the Reagan administration's response to those terror attacks when over almost 300 Americans were killed? What was their response? There was no response. Ronald Reagan, after that October 1983 military barracks bombing, by the end of the year, 1983, pulled back whatever military personnel was left to the ships on the coast of Beirut, Lebanon. And by the middle of 1984, those ships pulled out of Beirut, Lebanon, without ever retaliating for those two bombings. Look it up. It's true. And what would happen now if we lost that many military in two bombings with President Obama, the commander-in-chief, and there be no retaliation? What would be going on in the U.S. Senate right now? They'd be falling over themselves trying to pull up articles of impeachment. But this was seen as it was okay. We moved on. Eventually there was a bombing of, they tried to kill, at that time, Gaddafi was the bad guy, Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. And at some point in 1985 or so, they tried to kill him in a tent somewhere and ended up killing his wife and some children. But didn't get him. But we never retaliated. And for most analysts, most military analysts, that was the beginning of the anti-U.S. attacks by Islamist groups. That's when it started. And we never retaliated. So now jump forward to 2015, 2016, and we have ISIS, which came right out of the war in Iraq. Let's remember something. When George W. Bush, President Bush, started the war in Iraq in 2002, 2003, one of the first things he did was disband the Saddam's military police, his military. They disbanded the army. They gave them no jobs. Guess where those people went? The reason the Iraq war went so downhill in large part was because we disbanded the army of Saddam's, didn't put them in jail, just got rid of them, go, leave, get out of here. And they eventually turned their guns on the U.S. or became members of terrorist organizations. That was the beginning of ISIS. Now, it went through some growth, obviously. You had Osama bin Laden's group, And there was some changes over the years between 2003 into 2014. But ISIS came from, originally started, because George W. Bush, in waging the war against Iraq, disbanded the army of Saddam Hussein's and gave them no place to go except fighting against the invaders. So that's our issue with the war on terror. So how is the president fighting it? The president is trying to fight them. Obviously, you have to kill them on the ground. But I agree, boots on the ground are problematic. And this country is war weary. There have been enough military, U.S. military, in wars. Like I said yesterday, we are literally having troops. The U.S. military troops have come back from the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. They're literally dying at least one a day by suicide. It is just an amazing number. It's hard to believe one a day dies, but there's actually even multiples every single day because of the constant going back to war. Men and women who had 3 years in the military, but Rumsfeld and Bush decided to keep them in longer, and they had to have another they could never get themselves out. In war, I don't know all the details, but you cannot leave just because your term, your three-year, five-year term ends in a time of war. They can keep you in, and they can continue to bring you back in until they're done, until that war is done. And literally, the war in Iraq was not done until 2011, 2012. It has caused a toll. And because we are so much better with medical injuries than we were in the 1940s during World War II, more people are living now who would have died. But they are living with severe trauma, legs, arms missing, brain trauma. And most people know about the challenge that the VA has in trying to take care of the men and women who've come back from the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. So the president has to think about this in fighting this war on terror. Do you want to put another 10,000 people out in Syria and Iraq to fight ISIS? I say no. I say it's time that the Middle East starts fighting their own wars. And in time Saudi Arabia gets off that $200 billion that they have and starts getting some of the people who don't work and put them in the military. Let them fight their own wars. Because this war is eventually going to blow back on Saudi Arabia. They're having their own issues actually close to home. The president is trying to fight this by enlisting other Middle Eastern countries and, as important, if not more important, cutting off the money supply. ISIS has been able to get a great deal of money from oil revenue. They've probably done a better job getting oil revenue, money from oil revenue, than the Bush administration did in the war in Iraq. At one time, the war in Iraq was supposed to be paid for by oil revenues from Iraq. I think ISIS has done a better job than the Bush administration. But this president has done an effective job on cutting off their money supply. And they are being, and I believe that this president, the war on terror with ISIS has been not won, but they are winning. That does not mean that they will not attack still. That does not mean that a cornered animal will not strike out. And that, to me, is what ISIS is right now. They are a cornered animal that is not given any way out, and they're going to strike. And that is what's happened in Paris. That is what's happened in San Bernardino in other cases that we've had. There are sympathizers in the United States. Let's be very clear. There are sympathizers in this country who would like to carry out attacks on this soil. Our government, our Department of Homeland Security, our FBI, I think has done a pretty doggone good job on a daily basis, every minute of the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. When we talk about the fact that they have to be on point every minute, I think they've done a pretty doggone good job. But the fight continues. And I believe that this president, when it's all said and done, you compare President Obama, President George W. Bush, President Bill Clinton, and President George Herbert Walker Bush. Now, he may have done a good job. I'll give Papa Bush credit. There were terror attacks between 1989 and 1992. And obviously the World Trade Center happened in February 93, 1 month after George Bush, H.W. Bush left office. But I believe he had a better touch with foreign policy than his son, possibly Bill Clinton, because I believe there's too often Bill Clinton did not want to pull the trigger. He did not want to be too militaristic. I believe he felt tentative about pulling the trigger. George Bush had no problem with being tentative. He certainly did not know. George Bush was fire, aim, ready. President Clinton was ready, aim. He couldn't get to fire. And I believe President Obama has been able to fight a much more intelligent war, because some of that war is not on the battlefield. It's in the bank accounts of these terror groups. Cut off their money. They no longer have the funds to do the things that they want to do. So I believe he has done a good job with that. And I believe when it's all said and done, he will have done a very credible job, but he's not getting the credit right now, because there's just been too much in this Republican-controlled Congress that only wants to find things to say negative and never find anything positive. But the results are out there. Now, in terms of Boko Haram, which is another group that is basically in Africa and has been conducting some horrific terror attacks that have basically gone unnoticed because, back to race and culture, the people that are being harmed aren't blonde, blue-eyed, Caucasian Europeans or brunette, brown-eyed Caucasian kids in Texas. These are Africans in sub-Saharan Africa who are just getting brutally murdered by this terrorist group. And the governments in Africa are either in cahoots, Nigeria for one, or just impotent in being able to stop them. I think it's number one. The amount of terror that Boko Haram is causing in Africa is just beyond ridiculous. 86 children the other day, over the weekend. They killed over 20,000 in the last 5 years. Has any terrorist group, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, has any done 20,000 in the last 10 years? Boko Haram may have the highest death total, and I'll take a look and I'll get back to you tomorrow on tomorrow's show. They may have the highest total of casualties of any terrorist group in the last 10 years. And they basically go under the radar because it's people with black skin. So it doesn't stop the news cycle on cable news. And that's all you hear about, like with the Paris bombings in November or the Charlie Hebdo last January in Paris, where everything stopped for 2 or 3 days while we talked about those terror attacks, or San Bernardino. Boko Haram, it happens and it literally is like, okay. oops, not really discussed much. I don't know what will change that. I think one of the things that will change that is if these African nations, who are too often potentates, who are worth billions and billions of dollars, and they leave their citizens with nothing. That needs to change first in Africa, because they just, the leaders of most of these countries either don't care or are too insulated or just don't care. And I will say it's number one and number three. They just don't care. But most of the leaders in Africa are just, they take the money, whatever foreign affairs money they get or whatever oil money, and it's not spread out amongst the people. It goes right into their pockets and their cronies' pockets. And people are constantly killed. And AIDS is an epidemic still. It's been arrested some in Africa, but it's still an epidemic. And now you have this Zika virus that's going around in the South Americas and in Africa. There's a lot of potential in Africa. Obviously, the diamond mines are in Africa. Where do people get all the diamonds for all the weddings and the engagements that go on around the world, much less the United States? Africa has a lot of potential, but it is being misused principally by the ignorance of the leadership to the terror group Boko Haram, and I believe Boko Haram is in cahoots with too many leaders in Africa, and that's why they are allowed to continue unabated. That's my take. Let's talk about a little sports. Lighten the mood a little bit. The Super Bowl is the huge game this week. When I think of Super Bowls, you know, like I was talking about earlier, football is so ingrained in our militaristic society and how we talk about football, the terms we use that are used in both football and the military. And that Star Spangled Banner, which is something that is played at most military installations and obviously in front of almost all of our sporting events. And when I think about Star Spangled Banners in the Super Bowl, there's one name that comes to mind. And I thought I would play it because it is one of the most inspirational songs I've ever heard. It's a Star Spangled Banner, beginning of Gulf War, Desert Storm 1 back in 1991. Listen to this. When I hear that rendition of the Star Spangled Banner, as someone who's played a lot of football in my life, that makes me want to run through a wall. That was such an inspirational version of the song. It was at a time when the country was getting ready to go into war. It was the first Iraq war during the Bush 41, 1991, January of 91. And the country was in a militaristic feeling at that point in time. So that song, sung by that woman, as well as anyone has ever sang it, and as someone who played a lot of football and used the Star Spangled Banner before the game as that 2 or 3 minutes to get yourself in that frame of mind where I think I can say this, where you were ready to tear somebody's head off, but had to be concerned. I was the type of person that would be a little scared before a game, because you know that when you get out on that field, you may be taking your last step. And that's why I would literally think about that. Football is a tough sport, and I think we've seen more and more about it. It's going to be a topic of one of my shows next week about, is this game, football, going to last in this United States in its current form? It's a game where you can be severely injured for life. Those 2 or 3 minutes during the Star Spangled Banner, I got myself in such a frenzy mentally that the guys who played with me used to know, I would go into a different space. Let's just put it. It's the fun thing that I love about football. It's also, for some people, the dangerous thing about the sport, that you have to put yourself in a certain mode that makes you want to hit someone very, very, very hard. But that Star Spangled Banner and the way Whitney Houston did it that day will always stick in my mind as just one of the most beautiful renditions of that song ever. And as the Super Bowl is coming up this week, I hope whoever gets to do the song, they could do worse than actually running a video of that song done by Whitney Houston. That would be good enough for me. You know, I'm sure there's going to have somebody who will do it live, and I'm sure they'll do an okay job. Just over the years, I just haven't heard it done as well as she did it. So Super Bowl is coming up this week. If anyone keeps up with it in any way, you know that there's one quarterback who is a great quarterback over the last 15, 20 years. His name is Peyton Manning. He was great at the University of Tennessee as a player, and then he came into the pro game about 1997, 1998, and he has been a great pro for almost 18 years, broke a lot of records, absolutely surefire, no doubt, first ballot, Hall of Famer. And this may be his last game Sunday. So this will be made a lot of. And the fact that this is Super Bowl number 50. And like I said yesterday, you know how in this country we love to celebrate the anniversaries that end with a 0 or 5. So this will be a huge, huge game. 50th Super Bowl. They will go back to the beginning. CBS covered the first Super Bowl, so CBS is doing the show this year, so you're going to see a lot of old commercials from the 1960s and the 1970s, and I think the pregame is going to be pretty interesting beyond the commercials. I think it's just going to be a lot of nostalgia that's going to be shown, and in fact, that first Super Bowl was actually shown on NBC and CBS. They both showed it at the same time. It was simulcast. His historic show, historic game, Peyton Manning's potentially his last game versus new kid on the block, Cam Newton and his Carolina Panthers. It should be an excellent game. My choice in the game is Carolina Panthers. I think the score will be 30-17. But the challenge for Cam Newton and the Panthers will be the Denver defense is one of the best defenses in the last 5 years. And will they be able to stop Cam Newton? No one has really stopped him for most of the season. He has been able to run and pass his way. Their team has scored high 20s up into the 30s. Last week, 40 points. And games, and they've beaten some very good teams. They beat Seattle a few weeks ago. It was up, 31-0 before with 5 minutes to go in the first half. So Carolina has had a successful season, only lost one game this year. For most of the season, they were unbeaten. And I hope it's a game that is well-watched because Peyton Manning, I'm usually a team guy in football. I like teams versus the individuals. But Peyton Manning has certainly been someone that I've watched. I have a lot of respect for. If Peyton goes into politics, I almost don't care what party he runs in. I do, but I don't. I would almost vote for him. I think I have a sense of the kind of guy he is. He seems like a great guy, somebody I would have known if I'd have been in college with him. And while I'm not picking their team to win this week, he's been a class act. There's been a little bit of a controversy the last 2 months about some Al Jazeera report that he took HGH, which is a type of hormone that helps you heal faster. That is illegal to take for professional athletes. He's denied it. And, you know, people can go ahead and report about it. I trust Peyton. I know we're not supposed to trust athletes these days. We're supposed to consider them guilty before innocent. But if Peyton says he didn't do it, I'm pretty good with Peyton. I just have a sense that it's not something he would do. And whatever report Al Jazeera got, it's ridiculous. So we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But tomorrow's show, I'm going to continue talking about more the politics. I'm going to talk about Donald Trump. I'm going to really dig into who Donald Trump is, his background, his father, who he is. I'm going to talk about the Koch brothers and why they are a hindrance to politics in this country and why the next president is important in terms of our Supreme Court. That's what I will talk about tomorrow on the show, The Runaround. Thanks for listening. I will be back tomorrow at noontime Pacific Standard Time. Have a good day.